Well, I'm back. If you're still here after 17 hours, I salute you. And more importantly, I know you are ready for whatever life throws you or anybody you love. So I'm thrilled. This final two chapters, though, as I mentioned in the first chapter, I think are the most important of all. And you'll see why shortly, but just think about it. You can do everything right physically, but if you don't get your head right, your emotions right, the quality of your life will suffer. So let's jump in. Chapter 24, creating an extraordinary quality of life. The power of mindset. However vast the darkness, we must supply our own light. Stanley Kubrick, legendary American filmmaker. If you stayed with me this far, congratulations. By now you know the score. The thrilling dawn of regenerative medicine is leading us to radically healthier, more vital lives. The insights and breakthroughs of the health span revolution are transforming every facet of medicine. From 3D replacement organs to living drugs that are conquering cancer with our own modified cells. CRISPR and gene therapy are allowing us to literally redesign how our bodies function, and we're getting closer each day to answering the riddle of why we age and how we can soon might be able to turn back that clock. But there's still some critical questions left to answer. How can we make the most of our expanded health span? Is a longer, more physically vibrant existence an end in itself? And most of all, how do we find fulfillment? Here's the short answer. It's not the number of years that matter most. I think you know that. Let's return to the Vatican conference that opened this book. At a panel on longevity, Peter Diamandis asked the audience, how many of you would want to live to 120 if you could? Peter was astonished by the response. Judging from the show of hands, about two-thirds wanted no part of a 120-year lifespan, and these were people in the rejuvenation business. Why the lack of enthusiasm? I think it's because most people I know love the idea of longevity, but when push comes to shove, we want more than quantity of life. We're looking for an extraordinary quality of life. Good health is the foundation, no question. But people can be physically healthy and still miss out on the quality of life they desire. Why? Because they haven't yet mastered their own mind. They haven't learned how to make the most of their time on Earth, however long that may be. As we travel through these last two chapters together on this long and amazing journey, let's take a look at one last tool for health, healing, and vitality. It's the most incredibly powerful tool of all. That's right, it's your mind. If you're about to die right now, if the Grim Reaper were on your doorstep, you'd negotiate if you could, right? Let's say you bargained successfully for one more week of life. How would you spend that week? Would you be whining, worrying, complaining, regretting? Would you be frustrated and angry over some ancient disappointment? Would you suffer your way to the end? Or would you choose to leave the world loving and laughing? Would you spend those last hours on the friends and family you love, giving, connecting, sharing your most honest and intimate emotions? Would you try to squeeze every ounce of exhilaration out of every moment you had left? Either way, it would be up to you. We can't predict the number of days we've got left, but we can absolutely control what we get out of them. That's the subject of these final two chapters of the book, The Power of the Mind and What It Takes to Truly Be Fulfilled. Placebos and the power of mindset. Quote, the mind is powerful and you have more control than you think. Scott D. Lewis, mindfulness practitioner. Here's a fascinating example of your mindset at work, the placebo effect. What are placebos? They're harmless, quote, medicines or procedures that are used to test the therapy's effectiveness. But if you thought placebos had no real impact, you'd be mistaken. Many people have heard about patients in stage 3 or stage 4 cancer, and suddenly they shift into, quote, spontaneous remission, and the cancer's gone. Do you remember Jenny, my former girlfriend's mother, the woman given 9 weeks to live? More than 40 years later, she's alive and well still. Some people believe that these seeming miracles are the result of prayer. Others think it's a change of diet that made all the difference. But here are two things we know for sure. Traditional medical science can't explain what happened, and the mind contains the power to heal the body. There are countless examples of placebos duplicating or even surpassing the impact of actual real drugs. By mobilizing the brain's frontal lobe, placebos can have a tremendous power over pain, over medicine side effects, even over degenerative disease. Let's take a quick walk through the history of this amazing phenomena to show you just how powerful your mind really is. The placebo effect was discovered during World War II by an anesthesiologist named Dr. Henry Beecher, who'd run out of morphine in the middle of a German bombardment. Desperate to ease a soldier's pain, Beecher's nurse injected a syringe of salt water, but told the wounded man he was getting the powerful painkiller. To Beecher's astonishment, the saline soothed the soldier's agony and kept him from going into shock. After Beecher returned to Harvard Medical School after the war, he pioneered the use of, quote, controlled clinical studies for new medicines where some of the test subjects were unknowingly getting a placebo. By subtracting the improvement in the placebo control group, researchers could determine whether a drug really worked or not. In a migraine pain study at Harvard Medical School, the placebo was found to be nearly as effective as the actual drug. What made the results even more astonishing was the scientists clearly labeled placebo. The patients knew what they were getting. As the lead researcher noted, quote, "The placebo effect is more than positive thinking. It's about creating a stronger connection between the brain and body and how they work together," end quote. Not all placebos are equal, though. The bigger the, quote, intervention, the more profound the results. Higher placebo doses, bigger pills, boosted the effect. The placebo effect can be strengthened or weakened by the outward qualities of the placebo. Taking more placebo pills generally has a greater effect. Capsules do a better job than pills, and injections do better than capsules. And an even more powerful example is what is known as the placebo, or what some people call the sham surgery, meaning the person was put under anesthesia, cut open, but no repair is made, yet the patient is made to believe one was. In a Harvard study, 100 medical students were enlisted in a test to two drugs. One was a super stimulant red pill, and the other was a super tranquilizer blue one. Unbeknownst to the students, the drugs were purposely switched. The red was actually a barbiturate that would slow the body down, the blue an amphetamine that would speed it up. Even so, the subjects that were given a barbiturate experienced stimulation like an upper because of their expectations. And those that took the super tranquilizer, even though it was an amphetamine, their bodies slowed down and they felt tired. Talk about the power of the mind. These subjects' expectations actually overpowered the drug and reversed its impact to the very opposite of what the chemicals normally create. And I'll bet this one will amaze you. A trial at Houston Veterans Affairs Medical Center enrolled 180 subjects with significant pain from osteoarthritis. Two-thirds of them underwent arthroscopic knee surgery. The other 60 had a fake placebo surgery procedure. Both groups had the same prep and were cared for overnight by nurses who didn't know whether or not they'd had the real operation or not. The results? The placebo patients reported just as much pain relief and a functional improvement as those who'd had the real surgery. 1 year later, the placebo group was doing better at walking and stair climbing than the surgical patients. The results were so profound that the Department of Veteran Affairs told its doctors to stop performing those operations. They wouldn't fund them anymore. Now, you don't have to pop a sugar pill to get this effect. Simply changing your outlook can add years to your life. According to an Ohio study, middle-aged subjects with positive attitudes on aging wound up living more than 7 years longer on average than those with negative attitudes. And a research out of Yale found that older people with a positive focus on aging were 44% more likely to fully recover from a disabling health problem. In a seminal study on the mind-body connection conducted by my friend Dr. Ellen Langer, a professor of psychology at Harvard, took a group of older men in an isolated New England retreat, but with a twist. The hotel was retrofitted with every visible cue, magazines, TV shows, movies from 20 years earlier. The subjects were told to act as if they'd actually traveled back in time. When they discussed, quote, current events from the two decades earlier, they spoke in the present tense. If you did this today, by the way, you'd be dancing to Eminem. So at the end of the 5-day counterclockwise experiment, the men showed measurable improvement in memory, hearing, vision, grip strength, joint flexibility, and posture. Their arthritis eased up, and based on before and after photos, they even looked younger. It turns out cultural stereotypes about aging, good or bad, become self-concepts and self-fulfilling prophecies. Positive attitudes protect against dementia, even in people with high-risk APOE4 gene. What's the common thread of these studies? A positive mindset can reverse the aging process. Science is showing it now. Remember that saying, you're only as young as you feel? The science tells us it's true. Want one more piece of evidence? In a more recent study by Professor Langer, a group of hotel room cleaners were told that their everyday work met the Surgeon General's requirement for an active lifestyle. A control group wasn't given this information. 4 weeks later, the first group had lowered their systolic blood pressure, lowered their body mass index, and their percentage of body fat. The control group showed none of these improvements. As Professor Langer wrote, quote, "It is clear that health is significantly affected by mindset," end quote. Now that you know that your mind can simulate surgery or drugs or make you feel a generation younger, the next step is to control it, something very few people do. And here's the problem. An undirected mind tends to go to fear. We saw this tragically during COVID-19. Check this out. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the number two mortality risk factor for people with COVID, just behind obesity as number one, was anxiety and fear-related disorders. Fear was more deadly for COVID patients than severe diabetes, chronic kidney disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or heart disease. It sounds crazy, doesn't it? But the CDC science shows it to be true. And as we've noted, we have a 2-million-year-old fight-or-flight brain that evolved to protect us from saber-toothed tigers. The tigers are long gone, but our brain still overblows every, quote, crisis. It worries what people are thinking about us or that we don't have enough money. It turns bumps in the road into matters of life and death. But we don't have to play along. We can kill this fear monster before it grows up and destroys our life, our family, and our community. Quote, "Our bodies are apothecaries. We convert our expectations into chemical reality." Norman Cousins, American author, journalist, and professor. Look, we've seen that our minds can make us healthy, but they can also make us sick as well. And not only that, they can also create a contagious effect of fear. One of the earliest heroes in the science of neuroimmunology in the study of how the nervous system and the immune system interact was UCLA professor and best-selling author Norman Cousins. He was diagnosed with a rare autoimmune form of inflammatory arthritis called ankylosing spondylitis. And in advanced stages, the condition can lead to total fusion of the spine. It's incredibly debilitating and painful. But instead of sitting home to suffer, Cousins decided to cure himself by laughter. Determined not to let the diagnosis limit his positivity in his life, he found that just 10 minutes of deep belly laughter would give him 2 to 3 hours of relief from his agony. In place of pills, he would watch funny movies as often as necessary for pain reduction and good sleep. Many years later, doctors found that his arthritis had been stopped in its tracks with no progression. Baffled by the results, they decided Cousins must have been misdiagnosed and the condition had resolved on its own. Cousins, however, knew that there was something else at work. This is one of the best-known cases in the science of psychoneuroimmunology, or PNI, the study of how what we think, psycho, changes the brain, neuro, and in turn affects our immune systems. Cousins' life and work were so significant that the University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA, now houses the Norman Cousins Center for Psychoneuroimmunology. Now, I had the privilege of meeting Norman Cousins in my early 20s. He came to one of my events and even walked on fire. In an interview in one of my early power talks, he shared how the mind can make us healthy or ill, just as the CDC has found. He retold a story about the power of the mind from his book, The Anatomy of an Illness. During a football game in Los Angeles, a few people came down ill with symptoms of food poisoning. The doctor who treated them ascertained that they'd all had Coca-Cola from one of the two dispensing machines by the stands. He naturally wondered if the soda syrup had been contaminated or the machine's copper piping had corroded. But before they could pinpoint the cause, he didn't want anyone else to be exposed. So they went on the public address system and described the symptoms of the sick people and warned everyone not to drink any more Coca-Cola. Well, you can guess what happened. Within minutes, the whole football stadium became a sea of retching people, including many who hadn't gone to either soda machine. There were 5 ambulances shuttling back and forth, bringing people to and from the nearby hospital. Later that day, they found out there was nothing poisonous in the Coca-Cola machines, and as soon as they got the news, the people in the hospital stopped throwing up. There was nothing wrong with them. Cousins called it, quote, "mass-induced hypnosis," end quote. An acute physical reaction caused completely by people's minds. Well, there's no question that fear can cause a shortness of breath or temperature to rise or even make us vomit. So whether you're dealing with COVID, the flu, or going to the hospital for some procedure, mindset is critical. Since we live in a world today where fear is the cultural standard and we're supposed to avoid risks at all costs, most people let fear take over their lives. But here's the reality. Life is risky. It's so risky, in fact, that none of us are going to get out alive. So it's critical that we learn to direct and control our own minds. And once you master your mind, you'll make yourself not only healthier, but happier as well. You'll transform the absolute quality of your life. emotional home, and the three decisions. Quote, I don't want to be at the mercy of my emotions. I want to use them, to enjoy them, and to dominate them, end quote. Oscar Wilde, 19th century Irish poet and playwright. Have you noticed that people in certain parts of the world, including the United States, live in areas where there's a good chance they'll get wiped out by a huge hurricane or a tornado of every 3 or 4 years? You see it on TV and you feel their anguish as they collect what's left of their lives and begin to rebuild. And then it happens again and again. And at some point as you watch this, despite your feelings of compassion, you may ask yourself, why don't these people move? Why? Because it's their home. It's what they've always known. They don't want to leave. It's what's familiar, even if it's a disaster waiting to happen. What's less obvious is that we all have an emotional home. In good times or bad, we're going to go back to it. The external environment may be positive or negative, but we'll use it to reach the emotional place that we know best. And here's the most important thing to remember. The quality of your life is the quality of your habitual emotions. Where you live emotionally each day determines what your life is really like. Listen, if you have 3 beautiful children, an incredible spouse who adores you, but you're constantly worried and anxious, you'll have a worried and anxious life. If you're a big success in your job, but you feel inadequate and unfulfilled, you'll have an insecure life. Heck, if you got $1 billion, but your primary habitual emotions are frustration and anger, then your life isn't wealthy. It's poor. It's nothing but frustration and anger. As someone who grew up with abuse, I know how negative emotions can become a person's go-to pattern. If we're unaware of these habits, we create an environment that guides us back home to the emotions we've made habitual. Nobody wants a sad life, but for a lot of people, it's who they feel they are. Your emotional pattern follows you like a shadow until you consciously and deliberately draw on the line in the sand and just change it. The power of our emotional homes was made clear to me one day on the Big Island of Hawaii at a 10-day seminar I used to call Life Mastery. We had people come in from all over the world with translation for 6 different languages. We hired some of the creators of Cirque du Soleil to design the opening. It was filled with energy and excitement. There was drum music and confetti, incredible energy. And on the first night, with all this pandemonium, I ziplined over the crowd from a 40-foot ceiling into the back of the house. I'd rehearsed it all week. But when I touched down on the stage, people are going out of their minds. Somewhere in my brain, I called an audible. My soul took over my brain and said, living. When do people really start to live? I paused and I said, when they face death. I had no plan to say this or anything like it, but I took a long pause and then asked, if you knew this was the last week of your life and you couldn't get off this island, how would you live? What would you give? What would you do? Whom would you call? What would you share with these people from your heart and your soul? How would you spend these days? Whom would you thank? Whom would you forgive? Whom would you express your love to? And how much energy would you expend to squeeze every bit of celebration out of every moment you had left this week? Well, we finished that seminar that night around midnight, and by the time I got back to my room, it was 2:30 a.m., Hawaii local time. Half an hour later, just as I was starting to fall asleep, the phone rang and someone said, turn on the television, an airplane just hit one of the Twin Towers. I turned on CNN to see the same scene that everyone alive in that year of 2001 will always remember. Knowing that more than 40 of our seminar participants worked in the World Trade Center and had friends and coworkers there, I called my team and said, we better get more details in the morning to help address this crisis with that group. I tried to go back to sleep only to get a second phone call. This time they said, it has to be a terrorist attack. A second plane just hit the other tower. From that moment on, I was riveted to the television screen. I watched in horror as the South Tower collapsed. I knew that none of us witnessing these images would ever forget them. By the time the North Tower went down, it was 4:30 a.m. Hawaii time. I could hear people crying and screaming in the halls. It sounded like fighting outside my room. With thousands of people there for our event from every walk of life, from more than 3 dozen different countries, from every imaginable religion, well, it's safe to say they were all reacting to this extreme situation very differently. As I ventured to the hallway to connect with people, I witnessed every emotion of the human condition. Some people were shaking with fear. Others were so angry they could barely speak. And believe it or not, some people were celebrating. I knew that I needed to bring everyone together that day to align for a greater good in the midst of this total insanity. Ironically, the theme for that day's class was supposed to be emotional mastery. How could I use this opportunity to honor the people lost in this terrible tragedy while also creating a balance and perspective on what we could do to serve others? Before I share with you what I did, let me take a moment to tell you about a time when I was just 11 years old living in California. It was an extremely painful experience, but it also put me on the road to find the answers that ultimately allowed me to help this audience of diverse souls in Hawaii on that critical day of 9/11. The day I'm recalling was Thanksgiving. I was 11 years old, I was on my fourth father, and he'd lost his job, and we were completely broke. All we had for holiday dinner were saltine crackers and butter. My mom and dad were fighting, saying the kinds of things to each other that you can never take back. My little brother and sister were crying, and I was trying to protect them from the brutal battle between our parents, and then came a knock on the door. In the midst of all this chaos, I opened the door to find a tall stranger standing in front of me holding two giant bags of groceries. He even had a frozen turkey and an empty pan on the ground beside him. The man said, "Is your father home?" I said, "Just one moment." I was euphoric and ran back to tell my dad, "There's someone at the door for you." He said, "Answer it yourself." I said, "I did, Dad. He needs to speak to you." I held my breath with such excitement to see how happy my father was going to be. But when he opened the door and saw the groceries, he got furious and shouted, "We don't accept charity." And he tried to slam the door in the man's face. But the guy had leaned in holding the bag of groceries and his foot caught the door and it bounced back open. When my dad tried to close the door again, he leaned in even further and said, "Sir, this is not charity. Someone knows your family's having a tough time and they want you to have a beautiful Thanksgiving. I'm just the delivery guy." My father looked like he wanted to punch him in the face. He grabbed the groceries, slammed them down on the floor, and stormed off. This was a turning point for me. Why? Because it made me wrestle with the question, why wasn't my dad happy? I felt so grateful for this unexpected gift. Why wasn't he grateful? I was baffled and so sad. It took me a long time to figure it out. Years later, I finally realized that our lives are controlled by three decisions. You're making these decisions right now, even as you're listening to this story. And how you make these three decisions determines the quality of your life. What are they? The first decision we all make, decision number one, is what we decide to focus on. See, whatever you focus on, you're going to feel whether it's true or not, because focus equals feeling. If you focus on the worst case scenario, you're going to feel fearful and sick to your stomach. If you focus on the best case, you're going to feel confident. Again, whether it's true or not doesn't matter. What we focus on creates our feelings. I know what my father was focused on that day because he kept muttering how we didn't take charity and how it wasn't his fault that we didn't have food. He was angry, but most of all, he was sad. His real focus was on how he'd failed his family, and that was obvious. As he focused on it, he felt more and more angry with himself and with his life. I felt differently because I focused on something totally different. We got food. What a concept. How amazing. Remember, if you focus on the worst case scenario, that's what you're going to feel. If you're focused on people who might take advantage of you, you're going to feel bitter and resentful, regardless of what's really going on. Remember, wherever focus goes, energy flows. Some people constantly focus on what's wrong. Guess what? What's wrong is always available, isn't it? But so is what's right. What's the second decision? As soon as we focus on something, we have to ask ourselves, what does this mean? As soon as we focus, our brain has to make another decision, and that's, what does this mean? The choice directly controls the quality of our life. Because as soon as our brain focuses on something, we give it meaning. And whether that meaning is positive or negative completely shapes our life. For example, when something happens that's a big problem in your life, only you can decide what meaning to give it. Is God punishing me, or is God challenging me, or is this problem a gift from God to make me grow? In the interaction with another person, you may ask yourself, is this person insulting me, coaching me, or loving me? The meaning you choose will radically change how you feel and what you decide to do. Think of it this way. What if you think it's the end of a relationship versus you think it's the beginning? Will you treat the person differently? Of course. If you think it's the end, we're going to treat the person very differently, aren't we? Here's what's most important to remember. We are the creators of our own meaning, if we take control. Otherwise, we let the external world tell us what's good, bad, terrible, or horrific, and it usually isn't a positive meaning coming from the outside world. In the end, our life is controlled by what we focus on and the meaning we give it. In fact, meaning equals emotion, and your emotions equal the quality of your life. Or let me put this another way. We don't experience life. You and I experience what we focus on and the meanings we give life. So choose well. Decision 3. What am I going to do? Listen, every moment we're making these first two decisions, what am I going to focus on? What does this mean? Again, many of those decisions are made unconsciously. And again, meaning creates emotion, and our emotions shape the third and most important decision. What am I going to do? This is the make or break choice that defines your life, the one that leads either to massive action or accepting life as it is. But remember, actions don't happen in a vacuum. They're shaped by the first two decisions on focus and meaning. The emotions that grow out of meaning powerfully affect what actions we take. If one person's infuriated by an incident at their job and someone else is inspired by the very same situation, how do you think they'll respond? The same way or different ways? When a major disappointment happens, some people get depressed and others feel driven to change it. You know these two people are going to accomplish very different things in their life. So these are the decisions that we're literally making moment to moment. The problem is that most people make them unconsciously. So our life becomes a habit of failure or success depending on what type of habits we have in this area. Years later, I realized that my father and I had radically different experiences that Thanksgiving Day in California. To review, my father was focused on how he'd failed to take care of his family, the meaning he took from that focus that he was worthless. How do I know that's what he thought? Because he said it over and over again under his breath. And finally, the action he decided to take shortly thereafter was to leave our family. At the time, it was one of the most painful experiences of my life. I loved him as if he was my natural father. I focused, though, on something different, the fact that someone brought us food. My father had always said that no one cares about anyone else, and it looked that way from where we lived in this rough part of town. But my experience that day completely changed that belief, because some stranger, someone who didn't even want credit, looked out for my family. That experience that day changed my life forever. Why? Because I created a very different meaning that day, and it's probably one of the reasons I have the privilege of writing to you and now speaking to you in this moment. It shifted my entire trajectory. That day, I came up with a different meaning, that strangers care, and if they cared about me and my family, then I needed to care about strangers. That day, I made a decision right then and there that someday I'd do the same thing for another family and find a way to give back. So you see, it wasn't the experience that changed my life. It was how I processed it. I could have just accepted the food or expected someone should help us and been appreciative or not. Instead, I decided I wanted to pay it forward. So when I was 17, I called a local church. At the time, I wasn't very successful in business or financial terms. But with a little bit of savings I'd accumulated, I certainly had enough money to be able to provide some food for another family at Thanksgiving. So I called the local church and asked if there were two families who really needed food, but might be too proud to come get help, much like my father had been. I borrowed a friend's van, I put on some old jeans and a t-shirt, and I went to the grocery store with two baskets, and I filled them with food for two families. It was one of the most exciting shopping trips of my life. After loading up the groceries, I wrote two notes that said, quote, "This is a gift from a friend. Everyone has tough times, so please enjoy this Thanksgiving with your family. And if you can, someday help another family in some way and pay it forward." And I wrote, "Love, a friend." I also knew that where the two families lived were primarily Hispanic, so I had a friend write the same note on the back in Spanish. I won't bore you with all the details of that day, but delivering that food completely changed me. In one of the families, the father had just left them the week before with no money or food. There were four boys, all under the age of 10, and their joint excitement to see someone cared for them, well, it was overwhelming for me. I was hooked. The next year, I decided to feed four families, and the following year, eight. And then I got my small company employees involved, and eventually I was feeding 1 million people a year, then 4 million. Today, in my partnership with Feeding America, I'm committed to providing 1 billion meals in the United States, 100 million a year. And at this point, we've done it for 7 straight years, and we're ahead of schedule with 850 million meals. In fact, this book is providing 20 million meals as well, and the balance is being donated to some of the top researchers on cancer, heart disease, and Alzheimer's. Hopefully, by the time you're hearing this, we'll be reaching the billion meal mark. Why did I tell you this story? Because if you take control of your mind by making better decisions, sometimes the worst day of your life can become your best day. Think about it. If I'd never suffered myself, would I have the same passion for feeding people? Probably not. But our job in life is to use what life gives us, not to complain or whine or point the finger at those who've done us wrong. The real question that matters most is this. When life gives you pain and suffering, will you just suffer? Or will you find a way to grow and use it to find a way to serve others? My core belief is that life is always happening for us, not to us. But it's our job to find the benefit even in the tough and challenging times. And remember, your mind can both heal or hurt your body. As the placebo studies prove, the mind can even overcome the impact of drugs and get the body to react in the opposite way, to speed up after you've taken a barbiturate, for example. Again, it's not such a stretch to understand that our mind can change our emotions and therefore the quality of life. Quote, between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom, end quote. Viktor Frankl, author, neurologist, psychiatrist, philosopher, and Holocaust survivor. Let's get back to Hawaii, to the microcosm of humanity I encountered in my hotel on 9/11. As the sun rose that morning, I could hear the screams of shock and disbelief echo down the corridors. I could see that people's reactions were as different as the people themselves. Sad people really got sad. Worried people worried like they'd never worried before. Caretakers tried to comfort those around them. Some people were saying to others that 9/11 was retribution and the beginning of the end times. I had to make a decision. Would we continue the seminar that morning when everyone thought we should cancel? The U.S. had shut down its airspace. The phone lines were messed up. I pulled the 2,000 people at the event together in the room and said, listen, we can't get off this island, so let's focus on what we can do. Our first action step was a blood drive, but I also knew that our participants needed to process their feelings and their emotions because I was seeing every kind of emotion across the board. The first thing I did was ask everyone at the event to write down their answers to the three core decisions that I realized shaped my life and everyone else's. What did they focus on when they first heard the planes hit the towers? What did it mean to them? And what did they decide to do? And then I asked people to gather in groups of 5 or 6 people with a mix of different nationalities, both men and women in them. And then I went from group to group as they shared their emotion, and I got the lesson of a lifetime. As I approached the first group, I could see one woman with a thick accent who was whipped into a frenzy of rage. As she spoke, she was so intense that spit was flying out of her mouth as she shouted about what happened. After a few minutes, I interrupted and said, ma'am, I see you're really angry and I understand, but can I ask you a simple question? She said, what is it? I said, I'm just curious. I want to ask you, how often do you get angry? What do you mean? She asked. Well, do you get angry once a month, once a week, multiple times a day? She paused and glared at me and said, what kind of question is that? I said, the way you're responding tells me you get angry more often than you might realize. And she said, well, I do get angry a lot. I just can't help myself. Then I asked her, what does anger mean to you? And she looked at me and started speaking with intensity. And then a small smile crept into the corner of her mouth. And she said, well, for me, it's like jet fuel. It gives me energy. What an interesting response. But it was only one interaction, not enough to see a pattern. So I went to the next group, where a nurse from New York was sobbing uncontrollably. She kept saying, I feel so guilty. I should be there to help people, and I'm stuck on this island. I feel so guilty. After listening for several minutes to hear her out and about how guilty she felt, I finally interrupted and said, ma'am, can I ask you a question? How often do you have these feelings of guilt? She said, what do you mean? Once again, I said, you know, like once a year, once a month, once a week, multiple times a day. The woman paused for a moment, and then she said, I guess I feel guilty all the time. She felt guilty about working too hard and not having enough time for her kids. She felt guilty about not being there enough for the patient. She felt guilty for not being a good enough wife. Just as the first woman went into her own anger room, this nurse went into a guilt room within herself. After a dozen of these encounters, I began to form one of the most important insights of my life. Everyone in this room had used 9/11 to go to their own emotional home, to the place that they always go to out of habit. The attack on the World Trade Center was an extreme external trigger that returned them to their primary emotional pattern, regardless of what happens in the outside world. We interpret events as a way to get back to what we know emotionally. It's so important for us to realize that our emotions aren't based on our soul or our heart or our spirit. They're simply products of patterns and emotional habits. They're no more significant than a physical habit, like drumming on a desktop, but they certainly have more impact on our lives. So what did I learn that day? I learned that under stress, angry people got more angry, sad people got even sadder. Happy people looked for the good. In the most difficult situation, caring people were focused on helping others. Once we realize that our emotional home shapes our relationships, our careers, our parenting styles, even the level of intimacy we accept or reject, we can actually start to have a different life. Once we start taking 100% responsibility for our experience of life rather than blaming others, we can awaken to a truth that makes the difference. Whatever life offers us, we get to decide what to focus on, what it means, and what we're going to do about it. And if we do this consciously and consistently, we can completely change the quality of our lives forever. On that transformational morning in Hawaii, I called on another woman from New York whose boyfriend had proposed marriage to her just before she left for a seminar. She told him she couldn't marry him because her previous boyfriend had been kidnapped and killed years before, and she still wasn't over it. He responded in anger, "If you go to that seminar, then it's over between us," he said. As the woman stood before the audience to tell her story, her hand was shaking almost uncontrollably. You could see the dried tears on her face, the tears she'd been having for hours before the seminar began, since the moment she learned what had happened. She looked at me and said, "I want to play an audio for you, because last night you talked about death and whom do you love and what would you share with him. I realized I really loved him. But because it was so late back home, I decided to leave him a message that he'd receive when he got to work, so I wouldn't wake him up. In a message, I just told him how much I loved him and that I wanted to marry him and that I was sorry for all the difficulties." And then she took a deep breath and began to cry once again. She went on, "I left a message for him in his voicemail at work, in his office at the top of the World Trade Center. He called me in the early hours this morning, but I slept through it," she said. And she pulled out this little recorder, and she said, "I'd like to play his message for you." Then we all heard this man saying, "Honey, I can't tell you what your message means to me, to know that you truly love me as much as I love you. But I have bad news to share. There's a fire in the tower here, and it's so big, I can't get out. I'm trapped." His voice cracked. "I'm going to die, honey. But I want you to know that your message made me the happiest man in the world." He paused again. You could hear the cry in his voice. "Honey, I'm sure you must be wondering, how could God do this to you twice? How could he take away two different people that you loved?" "I can't answer that question, but all I want to say to you is that I love you, and I hope in the future you won't hold back your love. Give it all. I love you for eternity." As we heard the click that ended the message, the room burst into tears, myself included. I can feel them even now as I speak. But not everyone had the same reaction. A young man named Asad Rezvi from Pakistan stood up and said, "I'm a Muslim. I wish I could hold your hand and say I'm sorry, but this is retribution." He told people that morning that his only regret was that he was not on one of those planes. He'd actually been recruited into an Al-Qaeda camp, and his father had gotten him out and sent him to the U.S. for college. With his words, "This is retribution," as you can imagine, the room erupted into shock and anger. The interaction that followed is on video and available if you want to watch it, but for now, I'll just give you a summary. A Jewish man stood up whose family lived in the Israeli-occupied territories in Palestine. He'd worked in the World Trade Center, and more than 30 of his dearest friends had died that day. You can only imagine the intensity that passed between these two passionate people. But we took an hour and a half to do a process to get both of them to move beyond the external world and see how much pain there was for everyone. They both changed their focus from what had been done to them or their people to what they could do to bring them together. They shifted the meaning from being all about themselves to seeing how they could be part of a solution. After almost 2 hours, they embraced each other as brothers. It's one of the most moving moments of my life. Two people from opposite worlds found a way to connect. Afterward, they gathered all the Christian, Jews, and Muslims in the room and began working on a plan to bring more understanding to the Middle East. Later, Asad wrote a book called My Jihad, A Muslim Man's Journey from Hate to Love. As you see, if we change what we focus on, if we change what things mean to us and how we act, that's the only way we change our lives. Quote, "Be the change you wish to see in the world." Gandhi. We all got the most important lesson of our lives on 9/11, and anyone who was there will never forget it. However, the three core decisions aren't limited to times of such momentous events. They also determine the little things. Let me give you a simple example from daily life. If you ever had a dinner date with somebody you care about, your husband, wife, boyfriend, or girlfriend, and you're supposed to meet them at 7 p.m. at the restaurant, you get there at 7, and they're not there. When that happens, what do you focus on? What meaning do you give it? What do you feel? How do you react? When I ask people this in seminars, often they say, "I'm angry," or "I'm frustrated," or "I'm worried." Interesting, don't you think? Same scenario, totally different reactions. Then they say, "What if it's 7:30 and the person's still not arrived? They haven't called or text, and they just haven't shown up." One person says, "I'm really angry." Or you hear someone else say that they're really worried and concerned. Why are two people in the same situation having such a different experience? Both are waiting for a partner who's 30 minutes late, not arrived yet. Well, the angry one is not just focused on the fact that they aren't there. He or she is also giving it a meaning that the other person is always late or they don't care. Or perhaps they picture in their mind their loved one is screwing around with somebody else. Even if it's not true, that thought will make them crazy and angry. Am I right? What are they going to do when the person actually arrives? Let's just say it won't be a pleasant dinner. But what if someone's focused instead on the fact that they're not here and they start focusing and asking themselves what happened to them and that the meaning was possibly the other person was in an accident. Maybe they've been hurt. Their focus translates to feelings of concern and compassion. And when their partner arrives, they're going to treat them with compassion and concern. Notice, it's the same event, identical circumstances, but very different experiences to these two people. All that shifted was the psychological focus and a shift in meaning. What if all this wasn't about your partner? What if pre-existing patterns within yourself made you angry, worried, stressed, or depressed? But remember, there are also patterns that'll make you feel grateful, playful, loving, and courageous. You just need to be open to changing those habits. Maybe it's time to move from one emotional home to another one, or maybe upgrade your emotional home to something that's more beautiful, more nurturing, and more fulfilling. Beating depression without drugs. I've understood for a long time that our minds have an incredible ability to change our biochemistry and heal disease based on our expectations, hence the power of the placebo, from saline injections to fake surgeries. And as we've shown, our minds can clearly change our bodies to change our emotions. But sometimes we attempt to change something but fail to get the outcome. After a while, we begin to feel that it's unchangeable. We start to believe that there's something wrong with us, that we can't change. And once we have that belief, it becomes self-fulfilling and very little will change. I'm wondering if you know someone who takes antidepressants and is still depressed. I ask that question all the time on my events, and no matter where I'm going in the world, whether it's a room of 10,000 people or a 30,000 person arena, about 80% of the people raise their hands. How's that possible? Because antidepressants can be very useful in numbing people's emotions, but they don't deal with the source of the problem. The real causes can be found in people's patterns of focus, meaning, and action. Let me give you an example that you can test for yourself. Our pattern of focus and meaning powerfully shapes how we live our lives. Take this simple little test real quick with me, the same one I ask audiences all the time. First, we all have many patterns of focus, but let's take one. Do you tend to focus more on what you have or more on what's missing from your life? Of course, most of us do both, and it can be healthy to focus on what's missing when you're trying to solve a problem, business, or in life, but it's not so healthy when it becomes a habitual pattern. If you're always focused on what's missing, how can you ever sustain happiness? The answer is you can't. That's why so many people with such abundance are still unhappy. They're constantly looking for what's missing from their life, and that puts them in an altered state and not a happy one. Second test, do you tend to focus on what you can or can't control? In my seminars, more people are going to focus on what they can control, which is why they came there in the first place. They want to take control of their mind, their body, their emotions, their business, their life, their career. But people who are feeling depressed inevitably spend more time focused on what they can't control. And believe me, we all have plenty of things we can't control. If we habitually focus on them, we can feel extremely overwhelmed. And during the recent times of COVID shutdowns, you can only imagine how many people are focusing on what they can't control and experiencing a sense of loss, all the things they're missing, which brings sadness, anger, loneliness, and depression. Finally, a third test. We could do many more, but we'll just do these three. Do you tend to focus more on the past, the present, or the future? Now, we all do all three, right? But where do you spend most of your time? Depressed people often focus on the past more, regretting decisions or events that can never be changed. They may focus on present challenges, or they may project them into the future. No matter what drug you're prescribed, as long as you're focused on what's missing, what you can't control, and past regrets or anxiety over the future, you're going to be angry, frustrated, or depressed, no matter how many drugs they give you. But how can we address these issues? More people than ever are getting diagnosed with depression, the second most common cause of disability worldwide after back pain. Often they're treated with antidepressants, heavy-duty drugs that often carry unfortunate side effects that can trigger anxiety, agitation, insomnia, and even aggression. In young adults and teenagers, antidepressants have been shown to increase the risk of suicide, the second leading cause of death in adolescents. In fact, the pharmaceutical companies are required to put a warning on the side of the box that these drugs can create suicidal thoughts. In some cases, the treatment can be worse than the original disease. What's more, for many people, the drugs simply just don't work. According to Dr. Ariel Gantz, PhD, a postdoctoral fellow at Stanford University School of Medicine, Meta-studies, studies that combine and analyze all discoverable results, show less than half the people with depression respond to any antidepressant drugs, even when they're combined with therapy, barely better results than you get from a placebo. And even then, as she told us, their symptoms on average were reduced by only about 50%. Quote, "This is not people going from depressed to super happy. They're going from depressed to less depressed," end quote. Many people continue these treatments for years and in some cases for decades. Obviously, this is not a great outcome. The current depression epidemic, which expanded exponentially with the COVID lockdowns, has been pushing some scientists to find other therapeutic options. In fact, in a controlled study at Johns Hopkins, 24 patients with severe depression were given two treatments with psilocybin, the psychedelic ingredient in magic mushrooms, along with supportive psychotherapy for 4 weeks. A month later, this experimental therapy produced a result never seen before. Check this out. 54% of the people were declared in remission 30 days later. They were truly depression-free. According to Dr. Alan Davis, PhD, an adjunct assistant professor of psychology at Johns Hopkins, quote, "The magnitude of the effect we saw was about 4 times larger than what clinical trials have shown for traditional antidepressants on the market," end quote. There's just one challenge. Psilocybin, which is chemically similar to LSD, is classified as Schedule 1 controlled substance. It's not approved for treatment, and many people would hesitate to use hallucinogenic to try to change. Still, it holds exciting potential, and scientists and legislators are evaluating how to move forward. Over the decades, I've helped thousands of people eliminate their depression patterns in a variety of ways. We've done extensive tracking of the impact of our events. In fact, you may have seen the award-winning Netflix documentary, Tony Robbins, I'm Not Your Guru, in which a film crew followed me over 6 days and nights as I worked with several people who were suicidal or depressed. Or perhaps you've seen some of the training films that have been made by my brilliant partner, the master therapist and author, Chloe Madonis, that show the impact of these therapeutic interventions. In fact, our Robbins Madonis training, Core 100 and Core 200, are now used in the state of California as accepted continuing education credits for licensed marriage and family counsel therapists and LCSW, licensed clinical social workers, and LPCC, licensed professional clinical counselors. More than 100 films are now in circulation, including ones used to help train psychologists and psychiatrists. While I'm not a licensed therapist, the interactions and the strategies presented in the films provide healthcare professionals with valuable, quote, real-world learnings. With so many researchers now looking for non-drug approaches to depression, our organization was approached 2 years ago by a research team from Stanford University School of Medicine, Snyder Lab of Genetics. They're the number one genetics lab in the United States. The team was made up of Dr. Ariel Gantz, PhD, Dr. Michael Snyder, and Benjamin Rolnick, PhD, in partnership with Jacob Wilson, PhD, from the Applied Sciences and Performance Institute, and they conducted a unique experiment on my Date with Destiny event, a 6-day immersion program that I do once a year, the same one in the Netflix documentary. Though we've had thousands of successes over the years, they were not studied in a clinical environment and could be called anecdotal. So Dr. Gantz wanted to see if there was scientific proof to back up these examples. Mirroring the structure of the study done with psilocybin, but doing it without drugs, her team assessed a group of 45 participants who were clinically depressed before the seminar and conducted a follow-up 30 days later to measure the results. A portion of the subjects also formed a control group that didn't attend the event, but used a psychological tool known as gratitude journaling for 30 days. The results were mind-boggling. While the gratitude journal group improved some of their depression, anxiety, and stress levels for a time, but 1 month after the experiment started, however, the benefits diminished and the subjects trended back to the depression baseline. But for the group who attended Date with Destiny, the benefits persisted. Check this out. 1 month following the event, 100% of the initially depressed participants were in remission, no longer depressed. Additionally, at the beginning of the study, 17% of the participants experienced suicidal thoughts. 1 month after Date with Destiny, none of the participants reported suicidal thoughts. The study results found double the percentage of people no longer depressed than the previous study done with psilocybin, which, as you recall, was 4 times more impactful than the drugs on the market, and research showed our event was more impactful than that. How's this possible? Because these people literally changed their pattern of focus with corresponding shifts in their beliefs, their values, and most importantly, what they decided to do. Their meanings had changed, and so had their emotions and actions. 30 days after the event, with no drugs or side effects, they had a 100% remission rate. As Dr. Gantz put it, the experience, quote, shifted their underlying framework of beliefs in the way that they see the world, end quote. Quote, I've been doing research for almost 20 years and have published almost 300 papers. I've never seen anything like this. These results are absolutely incredible. Jacob Wilson, PhD. The researchers were stunned by the results. As Dr. Gantz told me in a podcast interview after the study was concluded, the impact was beyond anything she could have imagined, far greater than the efficacy of standard of care drugs, and even better than the psilocybin success rate. The numbers were so dramatic, she decided to double check by submitting her data to blinded teams of external researchers, and the results held up. In fact, the results were so impressive that the Stanford team collaborated on a second study on my weekend program, Unleash the Power Within. They wanted to better understand the physiological, biochemical, and psychological events that underlie the powerful emotional changes that occur at my events. This study, now published in the Journal of Physiology and Behavior, divided participants into two different groups. One group participated in my four-day weekend program, Unleash the Power Within. The second group was put in a control situation where they learned the exact same content I was teaching in an intensive traditional lecture format that was given by an individual with more than 15 years of award-winning university teaching experience. Participants' knowledge of the advanced psychological and behavioral principles known to impact the emotional states were tested before the event and 24 hours and then 30 days following. The study found that 300% improvement in participants' ability to cognitively retrain their beliefs and attitudes, reprioritize need states, and increase the intrinsic motivation and fulfillment. These results were more than three times greater than the traditional lecture format and were sustained 30 days later. The study also found that I was able to radically alter the physiology of the participants, including more than 2,000 more calories burned, 206% greater physiological output than the control condition. We also saw that participants increased hormones known to improve learning by 159%. Even more intriguing is that participants increased their ratio of testosterone to cortisol by 139% following my end-of-event priming session, which, by the way, I'll explain to you later. To experts, this is known as the index of readiness to perform. It's reflective of a signature of biochemical markers of achievement. Beyond studying a live event, though, the Applied Science and Performance Institute, a laboratory which has studied the greatest performers in the world, including Super Bowl, Stanley Cup champions, Olympic athletes, and thousands of subjects across lifespan from all walks of life, also tested my ability to deliver the same impact in a virtual Unleash the Power Within event that I conducted in July of 2020 in the midst of COVID. This study examined the impact of a virtual event for up to a year following. To give you context, when COVID hit and people were trapped in their homes all around the world, I built a state-of-the-art studio in Palm Beach, Florida, so I could reach people when everything was shut down. It has 20-foot high screens, the highest level of resolution possible, 50 feet wide, surrounding me by 180 degrees. And I worked out technology with Zoom and other companies so I could see and interact with people immediately during that live event, just like we're in person. In the study, they measured my biochemistry, including my levels of cortisol, the stress hormone, and testosterone, my variable heart rate. At the same time, they measured a sampling of people from all over the world, a portion of more than the 25,000 people in 90 different countries who were participating in the program for 4 days in our Zoom stadium. They were literally experiencing the program in their own homes, and yet, when the scientists took saliva samples throughout the weekend to assess the event's impact on memory and learning, the biochemical impact on virtual participants attending was the same as when they attended a live in-person event. We've talked about how lonely and disconnected people felt during the pandemic. Well, according to the study of our events by Applied Sciences and Performance Institute, feelings of anxiety in the control group increased 28%. But the ASPI found that people attending our events felt 38% less anxiety, not just 30 days later, but 11 months later. As ASPI's Jacob Wilson, PhD, told me, quote, I've been doing research for almost 20 years, and I've published almost 300 papers, and I've never seen anything like this. These results are absolutely incredible, much less for a single event that was held virtually, end quote. Why am I telling you this? I want to bring you back to the basic truth that drives this final set of chapters of the book, that you and I have the power to decide what to focus on, what things mean, and what to do. And when you make those decisions consciously, when you look for empowering focus, empowering meanings, and empowering actions, I can promise you your life will change. That's not a guarantee that your life will be perfect. That isn't the way life works. But I can guarantee that you'll be offered the opportunity to appreciate life with all its challenges and grow from whatever the world throws at you. We can't control everything, but we do control the most important thing of all when we do it consciously, what things mean to us, our emotions and our actions. Yes, we can control what we focus on, what we feel and what we do. And by doing that, we can absolutely enhance the quality of our life. So there you have it. Regardless of what happens to us, our minds can make us sick or healthy, miserable or happy, fearful or faithful and grateful. At our events, we don't sugarcoat the threats or the obstacles there in the world. We can't make the world a safe place, but we can shift our belief systems and feelings. We can help them change their emotional home and begin to live the emotions that empower them to begin to see what they can control versus what they can't. There are two games we have to master in this great life, the external world and the internal world. We can't control the external world. We can influence it, but we can shape and control our thoughts, feelings, emotions, and actions. Once people take back control of their minds and emotions, the dividends are immense. According to Benjamin Rolnick, PhD, Dr. Gantz's Stanford associate, people's experience at Date with Destiny not only brought down their depression levels, but it helped them to max out on gratitude, happiness, well-being, and sexual satisfaction, end quote. Talk about a testimonial. If you'd like to know more about the scientific studies or watch an interview with the researchers, you can visit us at scienceoftonyrobbins.com. That's scienceoftonyrobbins.com. I won't tell you I was surprised by these outcomes because I'm doing these events for 45 years and I've seen their impact more times than I can count. Even so, I was thrilled to have the power of mindset confirmed by such a rigorous data-based approach. If you'd like to experience it firsthand, come join me for one of our events. You can get information at tonyrobbins.com. You can do it in person or from your home. And you might start by just watching I'm Not Your Guru on Netflix to get a feel for what's possible. Now, let's turn to our final chapter and the most important tool you have to change your life, the final lesson of our journey. It's called The Power of Decision.